Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm joined here in the studio by Prince Nayar, the founder and president of Comdex, and Michael Flock, the founder and CEO of Flock Specialty Finance. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Michael, let's start with you. Tell us about all of your business entities. I know you've kind of been at the entrepreneurial game for quite a few years now. Describe all of the Flock empire, so to speak.
Empire. Well, yeah, I kind of transformed myself from a corporate guy, you know, several years at IBM, AT&T, and Dun & Bradstreet to Flock Advisors in 2007. We started that, focused on the mergers and acquisitions opportunities in the credit collections and debt buying markets. I got my experience in the credit and collections world at Dun & Bradstreet, where I was president of many of their subsidiaries. But I realized that there was an opportunity to go after the middle market for mergers and acquisitions, and I wanted to become an entrepreneur, although my wife had something to say about it because she wanted to move back to Atlanta, where she's from. We were working in, I was in New Jersey at the time, and so we moved to Atlanta. I started Flock Advisors in 07 to capitalize on the middle market for mergers and acquisitions, because there are no investment banks that really do a lot of the smaller deals. So I launched Flock Advisors in 07 to do that. Along the way, I realized that there is a giant middle market of underserved debt buyers, companies that buy charged-off debt, and yet they couldn't get capital, particularly after the crash of 08.
So when you say debt buyers, they are buying defaulted credit and then trying to take action and collect some portion of that. Is that
correct?
Okay.
Correct. They typically buy charged-off debt. Could be credit card, it could be auto, it could be consumer installment loans, it could be healthcare, it's all kinds of stuff. And what's ironic is because their deals are less competitive, meaning the price they pay relative to how much they collect is actually lower, so they get higher returns than the very big companies that buy hundreds of millions of charged off debt every year. Their returns are better, but they can't get capital because they're too small. Mm-hmm. So in 09, I started a fund and raised roughly $20 million from friends and family to start financing these middle market debt buyers. We were very successful from 09 to 2013, and then we decided to get institutional capital to go large and start scaling our company, and so we transformed ourselves from a fund structure to a specialty financed company where we merged the general partner interest, my interest, with the limited partner interests, and we're now financing many more debt buyers, not just doing charged-off debt financing, but also performing debt, subprime for the subprime consumers.
So now you have about $300 million of capacity, I guess, to invest in companies and provide
yeah, over a three-year period, roughly. Yeah, so it's roughly $100 million a year is our purchasing capacity now. And okay. We've got bank financing, and I've got institutional equity from family offices and wealth management firms, mostly here in Atlanta.
How have you found that process, talking to family offices and wealth management firms, as supportive equity partners in your business?
I found it a hell of a lot of fun just because I really am passionate and excited about what we're doing, because we're filling a void in, again, an underserved and fragmented market. And I've got a team of eight guys, all of whom have worked in this industry. So we differentiate ourselves in part because of the people we have. Mm-hmm. And, some of the hedge funds that might be in this space, have guys that are good, sharp finance people, but they've never, ever worked in this space. So we've worked in this space. I'm very excited about the products we've developed for the space. So, to me, raising capital, it's not work, it's fun.
So why would a kind of almost mom and pop sometimes, or a smaller company who's a debt buyer, choose to partner with Flock Specialty Finance? What are some of your unique differentiators?
Yeah, one is
other than experience, which you just mentioned.
Yeah,
obviously,
experience,
your team is
the operational experience of the team. So we've walked in their shoes in different shapes and forms. We have a financing solution
that's a peri-pursue structure, meaning it's a parallel structure where they put in 10%, let's say we put in 90%, and then every month the remittances, the collections from these portfolios that we finance get split in parallel. So the debt buyer gets 10%, we'll get 90% every single month, as opposed to a traditional senior-junior lending facility. So we set it up as a joint venture. So we are aligned with our customers. Plus, now we've done over 400 portfolios, and we've got a very large database, and we have a chief of analytics that manages that for us. And so I think our underwriting experience and skills and the information we bring to bear on the process is superior.
Talk about that a little bit, because so many businesses are facing what I'll call the data revolution. You know, there's just so much data out there, and some of it's insightful and some of it's not as it relates to decision making. Talk about that a little bit, Michael, because you're probably at the forefront of that, of the data analytics side. How do you go about getting your arms around all this?
Yeah, that's a great question, because yes, you know, there's tons of data out there. The key is taking that data, packaging it, and using it to underwrite the financing for the portfolios that we support. And so what we do is we can take comparisons of collection curves of comparable portfolios that we've financed, let's say, over the years, and we'll compare those actual collection curves with what's projected in the new portfolios that we'd be financing. So it's actually taking that data and adding insight to it through our analytics.
And, you know, we've obviously been through a pretty major cycle as it relates to consumer-related investment and debt, you know, from 08 to today. Talk about how, you know, how that's changed, what the kind of health of the consumer currently, generally, and, you know, how that's impacting your business.
To sum it up, it's been a hell of a roller coaster, let me tell you. But sometimes there are opportunities in adversity. Mm-hmm. And when we started in 09, the price of the debt was very low because the market had just crashed. And the consumer could not, you know, pay much of the credit card debt that was out in the market. So the price of that went down.
So default rates went really high because people were really struggling.
That's right. And the price of the debt in the debt market plummeted. So then it was easy for us to make, you know, good returns on those types of portfolios in 09, 10, 11. But then in 12 and 13, the consumers started deleveraging, getting healthier again. And so the charged-off debt market for consumers has contracted substantially. Mm-hmm. It was due to the deleveraging of the country, plus the government very aggressive regulation through the CFPB. And that regulation has made it very difficult now for companies to sell their debt.
So what's the what's the CFPB? Just for
the Consumer Financial Protected Board.
So this is a federal regulatory board.
That's right. Both for creditors, you know, big banks, credit card companies, actually anybody that is you know, selling to consumers.
Okay.
So they regulate the process of both selling and buying the debt with the intent of, quote, protecting the consumer. But in the process of protecting the consumer, they have added so much, I'd say, cost barriers to the process that it makes it much more difficult for both banks and investors and debt buyers to make money at it. So in those traditional charged-off debt markets, the volumes have contracted, which is why at Flock Specialty Finance, we're also now moving in to, I call them kind of strategic growth segments, those segments of performing debt.
So describe what some of those segments might be.
Retail finance is the first one that comes to mind. Okay. So if you fail to qualify for Best Buy credit, let's say, and for that flat screen TV, there are other subprime credit companies or credit channels that provide credit to subprime consumers. We would be funding those types of companies. In addition to, like we're looking at the buy here, pay here space, the used car loans. That's a huge market that's also big and underserved when it comes to providing financing for the subprime area. So we're looking at that as well.
So it seems like Wall Street or hedge funds have kind of entered into this business pretty aggressively, but is this ultimately kind of a local or relationship business, you know, or is it more of an institutional business?
Great question.
I sense that you guys are kind of more relationship driven and you're dealing.
Yeah, at the high end of the market, it's institutional and capital is a commodity. I think in the middle market, capital is not a commodity. It is highly dependent on relationships, information, the kind of product, the financing products that we bring to the market. So I think it's much easier to differentiate in the middle market.
Right. Is credit for, you know, subprime or below prime consumers expanding, or is it really contracting pretty significantly these days?
I think it's bottomed out. I think it's now starting to pick up again.
Okay, so the people who have the wherewithal to deal with the regulatory burdens or kind of have their act together and they're figuring out how to provide credit to people.
That's true. Obviously, we're not in favor of a lot of it because it provides barriers for credit for the very people the government is trying to help. That's the irony of the CFPB. So
it's really the people who perhaps need credit the most are having the most difficulty getting it. Is that the conclusion?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one last thing, too. We're about to do a deal with a company in debt settlement, and this is fascinating. There are companies that aggregate the debts the consumers owe across multiple vendors. And there's a company right now, there are several of them, but there's one in particular that's a leader in this space that has an awesome database. So they keep track of all the debts of individual consumers by their Social Security number. And so we're going to be aggregating all this. And so the return they get on these portfolios is far greater because of the information that they have and the history they have of negotiating, helping settle debt for individual consumers, which is a great public service, really.
Yeah, so that's the element of it. There's always kind of this one image out there of hairy knuckled debt collector or whatever, but
that's right.
But there really is an element of done right. This is something that that helps people, frees them from, you know, some past issues that they might have had. And
exactly.
There's a public service element to it. That's a great observation.
There definitely is.
Great. Prince, I'm going to switch to you. Tell us about Comdex. You founded the company in 2001, so you're coming up on your, 14th year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us about what you do and what your team's focused on these days.
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, what we do is we help our customers save lives. And you might ask, how do you do that? If you look at any emergency, any disaster, how much time it takes you to respond to a particular emergency or disaster can make a difference between life and death.
Mm-hmm.
When seconds count, the systems that we put in for our customers, whether it is state and local entities, police, fire, EMS, whether it is utilities, whether it's federal government, we build the systems that let them communicate, stay in touch with each other, and respond effectively to those emergencies. That's what we do for our customers nationwide. And you talked about how it got started, so I'll kind of share my story with you. Back in 2001, when I started to go into the business, I still remember I came home to my wife one day and I said, I think I'm going to quit my job and start this business.
That's a familiar conversation that I think all three of us have had with our better halves, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, how did your wife respond?
Well, I'll tell you, kind of, I'll put that in context, right? So, at that time, the economy had just gotten into recession, right? And my wife had just become pregnant with our first child. So, talk about the bad time to come home and give that. Any other woman would have kind of slapped me over the head and said, are you crazy? But she said, I know you want to do it. So, let's do it. We'll figure it out. I mean, we'll make it work. And the problem that I wanted to solve at that time was interoperability. for public safety communication systems. So what it is, and it, to some extent it is still today, but over the last 14 years we have gotten it better. What it is all these jurisdictions, they are very good as an island by themselves, which means the public safety entities, they can talk amongst each other, but they can't communicate with other entities, God forbid, if there's an emergency disaster of a larger scale that requires federal government to come in or other state entities or other jurisdictions to come in and provide help. So our charter was to go in and start helping with interoperability solution. Fast forward 9 months after I started the business, 911 happened. Mm. And if you look at 911 Commission's report, the number one impediment to effective response was lack of interoperability. At 9:08 a.m., when the buildings were burning, police helicopters that were circling 911, they were telling, hey, these buildings are going to collapse, let's evacuate. In New York City, the fire department, exactly the same time, was giving commands to its first responders saying, go evacuate the building. As a result, those 275 firefighters that lost their lives in those buildings didn't have to lose their lives if we had an interoperable communication system so that everybody could listen to what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't just happen there. In Pentagon, Philadelphia, you look at 911 Commission's
report. The mayor's office, you know, at a political level, everything was disconnected, I guess.
Everything. And that's kind of, I mean, that kickstarted our the business. And mm-hmm. I think with that came some government. It became a priority for the government as well. So to that end, we've done work in almost all 50 states across the country, jurisdictions across the country, helping them put in communication systems that help them stay connected in those moments. So whether it is, so if you look at our business, I look at our business as like a triangle. And the three ends of the triangle, if you look at the two ends of the first responders or whoever people in the field who need to stay connected with each other and share information, whether it is voice, video, or data. So mm-hmm. let them stay connected with each other so that sharing information is going on real time. And then at the same time, keeping them connected with their, whether it's command center, emergency operations center, whatever it is. So keeping the triangle always connected is our charter. Now, what we have been doing is bringing the latest technologies to the users all across the country, like here in Sandy Springs, where we are right now. The five cities in North Fulton, they were using antiquated systems. And they wanted to upgrade the systems, look at better options. So we kind of came in, and we are helping them right now transition from their legacy systems to the newer systems, the newer technologies that give them better interoperability, let them coordinate better, and at the same time give their first responders the tools that they need to be able to effectively respond to those incidents.
So it sounds like so much of your work really starts at that at the command center, so to speak.
That's right.
And how do you go about doing that? I mean, are you selling your products and your capabilities to municipalities who then control the fire and police and all, or do you go directly to the fire departments, or how does that all work?
Well, it depends. What the needs are. I mean, I think our job first starts with understanding the needs of the customer, what they really want. And I think what differentiates us from everybody else is that we are not pushing our products to them because we are a systems integrator. Mm-hmm. What that means is we design a solution that best meets the needs of the customer rather than trying to have the customer adjust their operations to best fit what the product we are trying to sell.
And so you're really indifferent as to what products they use. You just want to create the best system for
them. Absolutely. And that's where having done these hundreds of times across the country, the customers come to us because we've done it successfully so far. I mean, in our business, best advertising is word of mouth, because when you got a mission critical system where people's lives depend on it, you don't want the guy off the yellow pages or the guy that is the cheapest. They want somebody who's the best, who's got the experience, who's got the expertise, who they can depend that can get it done. So we've been very fortunate. We are the only company under $500 million in business, in revenues, that does this type of work in terms of giving the customer a turnkey solution that meets all their needs. And I think the other thing that really differentiates us as a business is the cutting edge of technologies that we are in. I mean, we are bringing LTE technology to public safety, which hasn't done.
What does LTE mean?
Oh, sorry. If you looked at Verizon and AT&T, they are touting their 4G networks and all that, which is that is the LTE is the long term evolution technology, which is coming to consumers, but it hasn't come to public safety because it's not public safety grade yet. Mm. Even like if you look at voice over LTE, even carriers haven't implemented that within their own systems yet. So what we are trying to do is bring the latest technologies, whether it is microwave, whether it's fiber, whether it is LTE, is they giving them more bandwidth so that they can now, instead of being dependent on those low bandwidth legacy applications, they now have rich information that they can share with each other. So think of this, if you're a first responder and you're responding to a fire emergency, wouldn't it be great if you can see the building blueprint so that you know exactly where you need to go to be able to respond effectively, have it on your tablet or on your phone or whatever. So to be able to, I mean, think of the other thing.
And so again, that's interacting with another part of the city government to get that blueprint.
That's
right away.
Absolutely. The thing is information is available.
Mm-hmm. But how quickly you can get your hands on it.
That's it. Okay. That's it. And to be able to share it, because with what the first responders across the country have right now, they don't have the networks with the bandwidth that lets them do that.
Mm-hmm.
So what we are doing is building the networks for them that not only let them be interoperable, but also have the bandwidth to be able to do this. So think of this, like I'll give you another example. So let's say there is a hostage situation in a building, right? Wouldn't it be good if there are helicopters that are kind of have a video on that that are seeing the whole scene from up there to be able to share that video live with people who are responding to that incident so they can see where all their colleagues are positioned around the building, how they need to effectively respond to go in and respond to that emergency. Better yet, I mean, this is the next level of interoperability that's coming is video interoperability. So think about this. If there are cameras inside that building,
can then speak to everybody outside.
There you go.
Fantastic.
So that's where the next generation of technologies is going.
That's remarkable, and it's really an incredible service that your company is providing to, you know, in lots of different communities. What are states and municipalities are notorious for being hard to deal with in the context of getting a decision made, and you know, kind of from a business development standpoint, how do you manage that? I guess one benefit you have is this is an urgent need and something that one of the key elements of what municipalities are there for is to serve and protect the citizens. But talk about that a little bit, that sales process on a nationwide basis.
The nature of the government is a long sales process, but the good thing is because of mission critical needs of it, if you meet a CIO and tell them that if you don't put a communication system, if you let your users use an antiquated communication system, you're putting their lives at risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if that is not fixed in a timely manner, then it could hit the press. And that, to me, is the biggest motivator for the CIOs, because they don't want the people who are actually putting their lives online to save other people for them to not have the best tools that are available for them to do their job effectively. So I think what we have seen is it's easy to motivate them. What becomes harder is to connect them with the funding to be able to do that. And
right.
That's another service we do, is kind of talk to the government grants and all that. So, I mean, where are those funds available where they have to put a fraction of the money, and there are opportunities with Department of Homeland Security and all that where they have funding available to be able to do that. Along with that, we are now doing a lot of work with the federal government directly as well. And they are on a mission to upgrade their command center, cybersecurity, information assurance, we're finding is a big need in the federal government right now. So like we just got a contract a couple of months ago for Federal Protective Services has command centers across the country that they want us to make sure that they're connected to each other and have the latest and greatest technology so that they can keep all the federal buildings across the country secure.
Wow. So in addition to that one, name a recent business, new business win that you're particularly proud of that your team's working on.
I think this particular one is we are proud of, but the one that really excites me is the one that we'll probably find out next month is there are hundreds of Army bases across the country. And what we have done is we are leading a team of 14 companies to put together a total communication solution for these bases so that government all of a sudden they get out of the business of managing the communication systems on the bases. So we come in as their managed services provider to manage all the communication systems, whether it's their phone systems, whether it's their radio systems, whether it's their IT systems, to have the entire capability to be able to manage across everything on their base. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, is over the next 5 years is going to $500 million opportunity. And we feel we've got a good solution in front of the customer, and I'm excited. That's going to be a transformational event for the company.
Wow, that sounds like an incredible project. You both talked about that interesting point in your life where you, you go to your wife and you say, "I'm gonna go do this," and take the risk to do that. Maybe make it less personal, but talk observations about the state of entrepreneurialism these days. We're kind of now in a healing economy. What advice would you have to people who are thinking about taking the plunge, or general observations about entrepreneurism these days?
I would say it's harder than you think. And just because you were successful in the corporate world, which I was, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be successful as an entrepreneur.
Right.
It is much tougher. But the rewards are much greater because there's the joy of creation. And you can get that in the corporate world, as I did at Dun & Bradstreet, turning around their collection company, or at AT&T, turning around a couple product lines and branch offices. But as an entrepreneur, when you put your life, your capital on the line,
right?
Life may be exaggeration, but I spent all my savings in 5 years getting started. In my transition, I called it the wilderness years from leaving Dun & Bradstreet to starting Flock Advisors. I spent a lot of time with private equity looking at deals. That was very, very expensive and very tough because the deal world is very competitive. And I think in the corporate world, you take for granted the infrastructure and the capital that is there. And so it is much, much harder to start a business. But right now that I've gotten over the hard part, every day's got its challenges, but we're very profitable now. We're doing really well, so it's actually so much fun. It's not like work,
right?
So
yeah, it's it is. It's 8, 10, 15 hours a day, and so it is part of your life. So it's
right,
it's,
but you got to have a plan too. You've got to have a plan that's specific and a vision to keep you going, and you've got to also have to really believe in it, because without that belief and the passion, you don't have the energy.
Right.
And so right now, I could do this. I told the my wife and the team, I'm going to retire 10 minutes before I die. this is just too much fun. And in fact, right. Occasionally I tell the team, I'm helping them grow their skill sets. We're getting into new markets and we're having fun doing it in spite of some of the ups and downs, the roller coaster I spoke about.
Right.
I said, this is so much fun. You guys should pay me for the education and the growth that you're getting.
I'm sure that went over real well with
your
employees.
Yeah, they had a good laugh about that. But
that's great. Prince, what about?
Well, I would say, I think for anybody who's starting as an entrepreneur, I would say 3 C's that you need to have in place before you think of taking the plunge. One is make sure you have a customer that's clearly identified who kind of is there willing to kind of bite on your product. Before that, the first thing before that is to have a very compelling value proposition to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a compelling value proposition that a set of customers is already bought into it, don't take the plunge. But then the third C is the confidence. Have the confidence in yourself and your capabilities that along the way you'll make it. If you don't have those 3's in place, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, when I went to my wife, I knew a set of customers that were going to follow me. I knew that our solution, our value proposition was compelling. At the end of the day, kind of, I mean, what really pushed me into this plunge is like, is that, I mean, what's the worst that can happen? Let's say it fails in 6 to 9 months. I'd go back to doing what I'm doing right now anyhow.
Right.
So that was the compelling event. And it's funny. I mean, I told my wife, I says, hey, it is, I mean, I know kind of we don't have much, and that's, it's a big risk. I mean, considering the baby is coming down the pipeline, I says, here's 2,500 bucks.
Yeah.
I'll put it in the bank. The day we run out of the 2,500 bucks is the day this business stops, mm-hmm. right? It's been 14 years since then. As a company, we've stayed debt-free since day one. We've been profitable each quarter since day one. And it's because, kind of, I mean, we have made sure that kind of along the way, we continue to refine our value proposition. We continue to put our customer first and have the confidence to take the plunge to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, I mean, at the end of the day, anybody who's trying to take that entrepreneurial plunge, I mean, if you don't have those three C's in place, I would say don't take the plunge.
Right.
I would echo what Prince just said. In fact, though, at our company, Flock Finance, we talk about the three P's. The three P's. First is the passion, which gets to the belief. And you got to believe that you've got a product. Your business model has to be, you know, solid and make sense. So you got to believe in it. You got to be excited about it because there's a market opportunity. Like us, we see a fragmented, underserved market way out there. The second P is perseverance. Perseverance is everything because it's going to be difficult and you're going to have lots of ups and downs, and there are going to be people that will tell you along the way, you know, you're crazy, you're not going to make it, this is insane.
We're going to crush you like a bug.
You have
competitors saying that.
You're
right?
A corporate guy. You're not going to make it as an entrepreneur, you know, so you have to have the perseverance to get through all this because you can be so close to succeeding and sometimes not see it.
Right.
So it's passion. Plus perseverance equals, the third P is performance. So obviously you've got to be able to execute and perform, but you know, with the right vision, the right team, the right systems, you can get, you know, the right product, you can get the customers, and you can tie those three P's together. So you can borrow my three P's. I'm going to borrow your three C's. I like that.
That's fantastic.
It was the confidence, the customer.
And a compelling value proposition.
And compelling value. Okay.
Absolutely.
Can I borrow that?
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, Prince. Okay. You can have my three P's. Okay.
That's great. And, you know, it's exciting because you both are now to the next. You know, you've traveled through perhaps several phases of your business development, but you're clearly in a sustainable growth mode. How do you personally keep the edge? You know, and kind of the, Michael, you talked about your passion for the business and the energy that you get. But as we kind of turn into growth mode, you know, and really kind of hit the next level, how do you keep that going? How do you keep that edge there?
Okay. My answer would be sometimes it's the market that forces you to keep the edge. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking about that book, Only the Paranoid Survive, you know, by Andy Grove. And, you know, our market has gone through such a roller coaster. And so while in 2009, 2010, and 2011, we were sailing high. We were very small then. But because the prices were down, it was easier to succeed because there weren't that many funding these middle market guys. But then the market shrunk within a year or two. And it's like, oops, you know. So keeping the edge, my God, I had to find, you know, new growth opportunities. And so I thought, well, let's be creative. You know, I've got an infrastructure. I've got a team that has analytical skills. They're good with customers. You know, we've got a solution, I think, that could be transformed for some of these other markets.
Mm-hmm.
So can you take your existing resources and leverage them into new markets? And these new markets we're getting into, the performing markets for subprime consumers, they're much bigger than the charged-off market. So, whoa, this adversity really forced us to create a new business model to go into these new markets with new products. And we're going to be even bigger than we were, I think, before. And so the team, their equity is going to be worth a lot more than we ever dreamed.
So there's this element of creativity and innovation that really is kind of putting fuel in your tank these days.
That's right. And so look at, I would tell your listeners, sometimes adversity can be your friend. And you don't see it initially, but if you can somehow leverage your strengths, the assets of your company into some new markets,
be innovative and create a new product, you might even be far better off than you ever imagined before. Mm-hmm. So keeping the edge is, you know, what keeps me the edge? The market, the change keeps going.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I guess from my perspective, I think what keeps me motivated is the fact that, I mean, we're making a difference. We're helping our customers save lives. I mean, that's to me, I tell my team, I mean, there's no nobler cause you can espouse than helping a customer. That's the most valued possession a person has. If you're helping people save lives, that to me is the best service you can do. And yet, as I go across the communities across the country, and to know that kind of communities across the country are safer because of in a little what we have done, to me, I mean, that motivates me. That motivates our team as well, because we're really making a difference out there in the world. And I mean, in terms of us staying on the edge, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, I think technologies out there. And what we always look for is how we can be in that blue ocean and swim away from the red ocean of competition. From looking at what's the latest technologies we can bring to our customers, how can we help them be more productive? How can we help them respond more effectively to incidents and all that stuff? So, I mean, we've been very fortunate to have some really leaders in the industry who kind of industry looks up to for those solutions, and having them on our team, that they are kind of putting the best solution, that really the cutting edge solution for our customers. I mean, that's what keeps me on the edge.
The other thing, right. Add one more thing. The other thing that keeps me going too is helping the customers grow, and by leveraging, showing customers how they can creatively leverage their own capital, in getting into new markets or having more volume or scaling the business or even doing an acquisition of a company in a new segment where they have no experience. It's the putting yourself in the customer's shoes, bringing capital and expertise to help them grow. And that's so exciting for us.
There's almost a teaching element to this, because as the expert, either in financial markets or in emergency response, you can bring so much to the table, and then you see it actually kind of get created in front of your eyes. That's really neat.
That's right.
I always ask people what the best business advice they've ever received is, and we've had some real gems over the all the shows that we've done. But I know I'm going to get two more today.
Well, I'll go first. I guess that to me, I think the best business advice I've gotten is to focus on the few priorities. Mm-hmm. I think as business owners, kind of there is. Sometimes we get distracted. There always is more opportunities than capability of what you can do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of times, kind of, I mean, you go chasing the shining opportunity that really kind of distracts you from really what the core mission is. What is it that you're really about to do? So, I mean, what I tell my team is everything that we do has to help our customers save lives. We are in the critical communications business. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't overlap with that sphere, then we are not going to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the companies that inspires me from that perspective is Apple. And Tim Cook said that, I mean, the focus of that's one of the most valuable companies on the planet. And if you look at all the products that they sell, you can put them on a coffee table. That's focus. You do few things, but you strive to be the best in what you do. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I think is the best advice I've gotten, is you focus on few things that are important, not urgent.
And oftentimes that really takes, that's where some of the deep thought is required.
Absolutely.
Is really to connecting that vision with execution to make sure that you get the level of focus and commitment from yourself and from your people that's required to win.
Absolutely.
I got some of the same advice, but the other advice that I got and valued a lot, and even more when I started running large organizations, is the human resource decisions, the people that you pick for your team and how you develop them are the most important decisions you make, because you can be super technical, you can have a great product. Well, excuse me, you may not even get to a great product if you don't have the right people, the right skill sets, the right experiences, and then the shared values and the shared vision. Mm-hmm. So I would say pick your team wisely, carefully.
How do you go about making sure on the front end that that shared vision and values is there? Is that something you spend a lot of time on when you're bringing teammates on?
I'll take a stab at it. I think one of the things we do is, I mean, we have our values and our fundamentals of the company very clearly defined. So it's a one-page document that talks about our six values, and then under the and very clear definition of what those values are and fundamentals. There's 26 fundamentals that support those six values, right? Every week I write to the team on what that each fundamental means to our organization. Mm. But then what we do also, so it kind of is ingrained in the culture of our company regarding what really those values are. But then when we interview people, there's a specific set of questions for those related to those values that every interviewer across the company is supposed to ask the new people. If they don't fit with any one of those six values within the company, they aren't joining our company.
Right.
And that's how we have been able to retain people. That's kind of one of the fundamental ways that how we recruit that has helped us be successful.
And, you know, it's interesting when you put that out there, it becomes very apparent whether somebody is a fit or not.
Oh, absolutely.
And so it actually makes your job that much easier on the front end. Maybe harder to find people, but easier to find the best people.
I agree with you.
Great. I also, we've got a few more minutes. I want to move to the speed round where I ask you some quick questions. Prince, I know you grew up in the North, not the Northeast of the United States, but Northern India. What did you always want to be when you were growing up?
Well, I guess I wanted to be an engineer. Okay. So it's funny. I mean, when I was like three, four years old, my parents still tell me, it's like when I would get a toy, the first thing I would do is break it apart and then try to put it back together.
Really?
That was the very first thing I used to do.
How about that?
So, I mean, back then, kind of my parents had named me, it's called Thor Ford Engineer, which is like engineer who tries to break things apart. So I guess I wanted to be an engineer, and that was a passion that kind of, I mean, I guess somehow I was inclined to. And as I grew up, it's funny, kind of all my three sisters all are physicians, and my dad wanted me to be a physician as well. And I said, no, I want to be an engineer, and stood my ground on it because that's how I firmly believe in it. And I'm so glad I am, because kind of, I mean, it makes you think in a certain way.
Yeah.
It makes you analyze things in a certain way. I mean, especially from business standpoint, it's been a great, because it really helps me figure out what the different pieces and how I can make them work and kind of be a little bit analytical about it.
So your sisters, as the physicians, all they fix everything that you used to break.
That's right. There you go.
That's great. Michael, what about you when you were growing up?
Well, it's sort of embarrassing to admit, and actually it's kind of funny, but, you know, I love history, and I love government and politics. That was sort of a hobby of mine, and actually I got pretty active in it in college, and so I guess there was a point that I said, okay, I'm going to be president, you know. I want to be president. If I can't do that, I'll do Secretary of State. So in college, I worked at the White House and in the Nixon years, and then also went over to France on a Fulbright and studied at the Institute of Political Science there. And thought, I love international relations, but I realized I couldn't make much money, and I thought maybe I could be happier, you know, if I find a job that could in a related field. So I got into International Business Machines, IBM, and so that launched my business career.
But, interesting. As a student of history, who's your favorite president?
Gosh, there's so many good ones. Actually, there's some bad ones, but I would say, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. I'm a UVA guy, so I have to say I love Thomas Jefferson.
There you go. the,
but I'm also a fan of Winston Churchill. In fact, I just contributed to the Millennium Gate exhibit of some of Churchill's paintings that had never been shown before. So he was a great leader and
really a Renaissance man too. Some of his paintings are just remarkable.
Very much a Renaissance man, and also a man that valued the importance of language in leadership.
And I'm reading a book right now by Jonathan Rose called The Literary Churchill. And it's all about how he used language, both written and oratorical.
Hmm.
And oddly enough, Oscar Wilde was one of his heroes because he was so witty and clever with how he used language.
Interesting. Great. What are you reading these days, Prince, or a favorite book that's been meaningful to you?
Well, I mean, my favorite book is Blue Ocean Strategy. I think that's probably one of the books that I've enjoyed reading, and it makes you think in a very different way in terms of how you can really create a blue ocean for you by combining different elements of you in your competitive strategy. So I think the book that I read last quarter, which really had a big impact on me, and we're actually implementing that within our company, is Four Disciplines of Execution.
That's that Franklin Covey book by Jim Huling and Chris McChesney, right?
That's exactly right, okay. Yeah. And fortunately, I had a chance to listen to Chris last year as well, so that kind of solidified the concept of the book, which kind of, if you look at it, kind of brings you back to focusing on a few priorities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have one wildly important goal that each and every person within the company is focused on, that's growing satisfied customers.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I mean, I think if you can focus on customer satisfaction and making sure the customers are getting what we promised them to, I mean, that business will take care of itself. I mean, my dad used to say that take care of those who are near and those who are far will come.
Mm.
And that is, I mean, ingrained in me that, I mean, I think if you can have satisfied customers, I mean, the business, you don't have to worry about the business growth or profitability, everything else. And to make that happen, I think it's critical to have employees who are happy.
Right, right.
Because if you don't have employees who are happy, your customers will never be happy. Mm-hmm. So as a business owner, I mean, you have to work on making sure that, number one, you are staying in touch with the customer's needs, but also you're staying in touch with your employees' needs, and you're growing them along the way and making sure you're meeting their needs and helping them go where they want to go. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have those two elements in place, your business will take care of itself, and the profitability from what shareholders want, everything else will fall in place. I think those two are the critical needs.
Right. Michael, you were going
to
add something?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. That's why I think those human resource decisions are critical.
Absolutely.
Who you pick and how you develop them, how you align them, their skills or experiences with your customers, and then that helps your investors. So it's alignment of investors, customers, and employees. It all ties together. I agree with you, Prince.
That's great. One last question. Favorite organization or charity that you're involved with? You know, one of the things that strikes me every week is how generous business owners are, and sometimes that's lost in the reporting that's done by the traditional media.
I joined the board of the Atlanta History Center a couple years ago, and my term was just renewed, and so my wife and I donate to them, and they've got a terrific set of programs and a lecture series that they just won the Cyclorama, and they do a lot of fundraising, I think, for important historical events here in Atlanta, and I think the new leadership that Sheffield Hale has brought has been extraordinary, and it's just a hell of a lot of fun, even for a Yankee. they're doing a lot, and I think it's going to help education for our kids who are growing up here in Atlanta as well.
So. Really, one of the most impressive Civil War artifacts mm-hmm. and era standing exhibits in the country, as well as many other things that are Atlanta-centric. Yeah. Thank you.
For me, the one that I'm involved with is BAPS, which is actually an Indian charity that does work worldwide. So like when we had disasters here like Katrina and 911 and all that stuff, I mean, they were involved in those events. And as well as if you look at, so kind of me and my wife, kind of we are involved in that. And then there is a children's charity that we are involved in as well. So I think those are the two ones that we contribute our time and resources to.
Fantastic. Thank you. This has been really great. You guys have just been founts of wisdom for our listeners, and we really appreciate that. How do we learn more about both of your companies?
I think the way to learn, I think our website is pretty informative in terms of what we are doing, what the company's history is, and our technologies and solutions that we offer to our customers. So that's I think the website is www.comdesk. It's spelled as comdex.com. So www.comdex.com. I think you'll find all the information there.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
Same for me. The website, www.flockfinance.com. That's F-L-O-C-K, finance.com. And then call me personally. My contact information is there.
Fantastic. Again, thank you both. This has been fantastic. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast, sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.